AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha. Always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by Clear.
I'm Stacey Lynn in Washington. Sad news from the Vatican. Pope Emeritus Benedict XVI has died. He was the first pontiff in nearly six decades to resign.
In February of 2013 came the announcement no one on earth was expecting.
Benedict XVI, 85 years old and frail, told a meeting of cardinals he no longer has the physical and mental strength to carry out his responsibilities.
The spiritual leader said he was going to retire, the first pope in centuries to voluntarily do so. As Pope Emeritus, Benedict chose to spend the rest of his days in prayer and contemplation. Steve Kathan, CBS News.
His funeral will be this Thursday. A trailblazing journalist has also died. Barbara Walters is being remembered today. Here's correspondent Jimmy Yukas.
Walters started in the early 1960s as writer and researcher on NBC's Today Show, but soon moved to a job in front of the cameras.
Thank you, Barbara Walters, for all that hard work.
In 1976, Walters left NBC for ABC, where she became the first woman to co-anchor a network evening news broadcast.
And I'm very pleased to be with you, Harry, and
she was with ABC for 40 years. Barbara Walters was 93. Now that 6 years of former President Trump's tax returns are out, what happens now? CBS's Robert Costa tells us.
While his tax returns are being released at some level, his finances remain under investigation in New York. So this is not the end of the story.
It's been nearly 7 weeks since the brutal murder of four University of Idaho students, and finally an arrest has been made. 28-year-old Brian Christopher Koberger is facing four counts of first-degree murder. Steve Gunkov's daughter, Kaylee, was one of the students killed.
This is the first bit of joy that we've had in close to 7 weeks.
Air raid sirens have been blaring in Kyiv today. BBC's Hugo Bachego.
Ukrainians rushed to shelters after the air raid alert sounded at lunchtime on the last day of the year, which is traditionally busy with celebrations. In Kyiv, emergency workers have been sent to three districts hit by explosions. Air defense has been activated in regions across the country.
Ukrainian officials say Russia has launched more than a dozen missiles. Deciding where to go party and ring in 2023 is a big decision, but figuring out how to get home, especially if you've had some champagne, is another. There's always Uber and Lyft, but be prepared to wait and pay more because it's a big night with a lot of demand. You should check with your city's public transportation as some are offering free rides on New Year's Eve to make sure you get home safe. This is CBS News.
Brought to you by Clear, a faster, easier way through airport security. Try today for 2 months free by visiting clearme.com/CBS22 or use code CBS20.
A progressive voice from Manitowoc to Janesville. WAUK 540 AM. Always streaming at waukradio.com.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. The long-term effects of Wisconsin's redistricting process were apparent in the November elections. A nonpartisan good government group says voters who feel overlooked should not give up. Mike Moen reports.
Democratic Governor Tony Evers won re-election, but Republicans maintained strong control over the legislature. Jay Heck of the group Common Cause points out that Evers maintains his veto power, but he says Republicans still carry a lot of weight, partly because they keep redrawing the maps to their advantage.
There were more votes cast for Democratic candidates statewide than Republican. But the contrast with the legislative elections in the state is so sharp, it almost makes laughable the idea that we have a true representative democracy.
Researchers have said that over the past decade, Wisconsin has produced among the most gerrymandered voting district maps in the country. Heck says voters should look ahead to next year's state Supreme Court election with the hope a less politicized court could eventually revisit the issue. And there could be legislation floated again next year to develop an independent redistricting process. In the meantime, he says the current maps allow a smaller percentage of voters to decide who controls the legislature, leaving other voters behind in fair representation.
Urban areas in Wisconsin have suffered a decline in the shared revenue from the state, even though those people pay taxes.
Heck says that means less support for schools, roads, and other public needs. Analysts say lawmakers representing these areas get packed into boundaries that ultimately diminish their voices at the state capitol. Mike Moen, Wisconsin News Connection. Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell.
Women hear a lot about self-care these days. Advice on ways to relax, exercise, eat healthy, and more. Those are all great. But one of the most important self-care steps we can take is making sure we're financially secure later in life. That means saving money for retirement. It's never too late to start. And it's the kind of self-care that brings peace of mind that lasts. For small steps you can take to save for retirement, visit WeSaySaveIt.org. That's WeSaySaveIt.org. A message from AARP and the Ad Council.
The Shaw 101 FM, your fix for progressive talk, from Butler to Windlake. Always streaming at waukradio.com. You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media. To learn more, go to our website, civicmedia.com.
Welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel.
You don't know me, but I'm your brother.
Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
Good morning and welcome to our second hour here. We're live at the studios of WAUK Radio in downtown Waukesha. It's the Shaw, 540 AM, 101 FM. And by that, we, I mean me and my producer, Calvin. And along with Calvin, I'm taking your phone calls at 844-967-2789. This, plainly, the last broadcast of Morning Cannolis of 2022. But back again next Saturday, continuing beyond next Saturday, always every Saturday morning, talking about law, talking about the big stories in government and the aspiration for justice in America. As we were going into break over the top of the hour this morning on Saturday, December 31st, we were chatting about this other major news story having to do with the return of major news coming out of Washington once again, the release by the Department of Treasury of the former president's tax returns for about six different years immediately preceding his presidency, beginning in 2015, and including 2020. That is the year in which, of course, he left the presidency. Those requests being made by the House Ways and Means Committee, also by the Joint Committee on Taxation. The release on Friday morning, just yesterday, of thousands of pages of tax documents, including individual returns for it by Mr. Trump and also his wife, Melania. Business returns for several of the hundreds of companies that make up his real estate and other business holdings. Really a sprawling business organization. Right now, the subject of an awful lot of review and analysis. But we do know, based upon some early reporting coming out of the House Ways and Means Committee, and also some initial review of those returns and those many, many documents released, we do know some things about the former president's taxes, and some things, not complete things, some things about his business holdings. Let's do one of the major findings that was the subject of the House committee report that described the failure of the United States Department of Treasury in the first 2 years of the Trump presidency to do what the Treasury Department has done for every other term of a president in recent contemporary history, and that is conduct an audit. You may recall well that during the course of the campaign, 2015-2016, the now former president maintained that he could not release his tax returns because they were under audit. That, as a pure matter of law and process and procedure, is wrong. That's false. Any one of us can, at any time, release publicly. We can post them on social media, if you like, our own tax returns. What cannot happen is the IRS does not have the authority to release those on behalf of government absent a specific need. So, for example, inside the Department of Justice, if there is a reason to have those tax returns for the pursuit of a legitimate, a credible, a justified criminal investigation, there is a process for getting those tax returns. Again, not released in the public, but in pursuit of a criminal investigation. Likewise, United States Congress, pursuant to established statute of authority, can in fact get those tax returns, not only as a matter of its oversight authority. One of the significant things that the United States Congress, through its committee, does, but also determining whether there should be changes in the law with respect to things that may be revealed in those tax returns. And again, every president until President Trump has disclosed voluntarily his tax returns. Joe Biden, in the first years of his term, has done the same thing so that we can know what our president is all about when it comes to finances and business and economics. This past week, once again, we're not only getting this report, but also these thousands of pages of tax materials. The significant point coming out of the top of this report is for the first couple of years of the Trump administration, for reasons not yet known, the United States Department of Treasury did not, in fact, conduct its internal non-public audit of the president's taxes as it has done and continues to do now for President Biden and presidents preceding Trump as well. We don't know about that, but certainly that's the kind of thing that a House Ways and Means Committee will be taking a look at. Certainly the kind of thing that even the present Secretary of Treasury, Janet Yellen, should be looking at, trying to determine whether or not there was a reason for this. Why did that happen? Was there a suspension? What was the reason for the suspension of that regular policy for 2 years at the start of the Trump administration? That a major big takeaway from the release of these tax returns, some you will hear more about down the road. More significant, we know that from the release of these tax returns, lots of information about what the president did and did not pay. From the top line details from these returns, we know that Donald Trump paid about $1.1 million in federal income taxes during the first 3 years of his presidency, including a measly small $750 in federal tax return taxes in 2017, which was his first year in office. He paid no tax whatsoever in 2020 as his income dwindled and his business losses mounted. Again, reflecting that even on these top line reviews of these thousands of documents, not the major, major strong businessman that he would otherwise suggest that he would have wanted us to believe during his presidency, both before and after that. We know as well that during 2018, with about $24.3 million in income, Mr. Trump paid about $1 million in taxes. 2019, as he was nearing the end of his term of presidency, reported about $4.4 million in income and paid $133,445 in taxes. Again, we know that for a couple of years during this six-year period of time, paid no tax whatsoever or paid about $750. We know as well, based upon some of the initial reviews of these documents and materials coming out of that, that in 2020, Mr. Trump paid nothing in charitable contributions. And why is that? Why is that significant? Well, you'll recall as well that during the course of the campaign, that he promised to give every single one of the dollars of the $400,000 salary that the president makes on a regular annual basis. He said, "I'm totally giving up my salary if I become president." And in the first 3 years in office, Mr. Trump did say that he donated his salary quarterly. But in 2020, his last full year in office, the documents that are now released to the House committee show that he reported $0 in charitable giving at all. And as 2020, as the pandemic recession descended a bit, Mr. Trump also reported heavy business losses and no federal tax liability as well. Some of this also coming out of the review is that Fred Trump, who is the president's father, still plays a major role, if you will, in the continuing financial status, the business activity of the now former president. In 2018, for example, after a decade in which the former president declared no taxable income as well, he reported a taxable income again, as I said, about $24 million, paid this $1 million in federal taxes, nearly the entire amount that he paid as president. And you say, well, gee, where does that come from? Well, the materials indicate, again, first blush, as we're reviewing all of this, that they appear to result from more than $14 million in gains from the sale of an investment his father had made in the 1970s. And that was a Brooklyn housing complex named Starrett City, which then became a part of Mr. Trump's inheritance. These new documents, again, coming out this past week, including just yesterday, showed that the effect of that inheritance in 2018 was actually more great than what one might otherwise have anticipated. Donald Trump reported about $25.7 million in gains from the sale of those business properties that he and his siblings inherited from his father and took through trusts, including the sale of this Starrett City enterprise that he inherited from his father. Those sales of properties created basically a loss for Donald Trump, our former president, dragging down his net proceeds for that period of time and somewhat reducing his tax liability, as the itemization in some of those documents appears to show. So a lot of analysis coming out of that, more coming out of that, certainly as the documents are further reviewed. Also a lot of concern, a lot of suggestion about the nature of the charitable contributions the former president did in fact make, a lot of those in cash without documentary support. As you know, a part of that required by the IRS that you demonstrate not only the amount of money that you show at certain levels, but also that be demonstrated in the documents attached to a part of your regular tax returns. Questions about that, which leads me to my other comment, which is, what is next? What is next from coming from these tax returns? Undeniably, the Department of Treasury still looking at the nature of these tax returns. We don't know about exactly what Janet Yellen and the enforcement side of the Treasury Department may be examining in particular, but certainly given some of the questions about not only the charitable contributions, other things accomplished by virtue of these documents now being released at what they show, subject to an awful lot of analysis, could in fact, if indeed there were federal criminal tax violations, could be the result of this analysis ongoing right now, could be producing ultimately a civil tax prosecution, a criminal tax prosecution. We don't know. It's much too early to tell. But all of those things, plainly not only now the subject of congressional review, again, in its oversight capacity, determining what, if anything, it should do in the future for future legislation, but also probably by the tax division of the Department of Justice, looking at all of this and determining whether or not there should be further enforcement action with respect to these past, perhaps even continuing present tax status of our former president. Again, the big news coming out of this that the IRS during these initial years of the president's term didn't review this, didn't do an audit at all, and unmistakably, the House Ways and Means Committee, at least right now, in its final hours of existence, looking at that issue as well. Come back after the break as we talk more about issues in America, including January 6th and the report by the House Select Committee. We're talking about all of that right after this next break.
Welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel.
You don't know me, but I'm your brother.
Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
the years, you've really kept up with the times. You're on social media.
Like, dislike, block.
Maintained your health.
10,000 steps. I'm a beast.
You even programmed your own smart home.
In 10 minutes, remind me that I'm a genius.
In 10 minutes, I'll remind you that you're a genius.
If you can do all that, you can definitely save for retirement. Just go to aceyourretirement.org, a free online tool sponsored by AARP that can help you get on track with your retirement savings no matter your age. At aceyourretirement.org, you'll meet Avo, the friendly digital retirement coach, and in just 3 minutes, get personalized recommendations to help boost your retirement savings. They're easy to understand and work with your lifestyle. It's quick, easy, and free. Plus, it's brought to you by AARP, so you know they got your back.
You are a genius.
Take charge of your retirement. Go to aceyourretirement.org now. That's aceyourretirement.org. A message from AARP and the Ad Council.
What is dedication?
My biggest fear in the middle of my addiction was that my kids wouldn't have a father. And I started thinking, you know what? This isn't my story. I definitely had to become a better man to be a better father. It's important to me that my kids are empowered and truly believe.
And we are back here on Morning Cannolis. Thank you once again for joining me on this last day of the calendar year. We're talking now in the final segments of Morning Cannolis about the other major news issue coming out of Washington, D.C., and that is released by the House Select Committee on the January 6th insurrection, the release of its final findings through a major hearing that it conducted on December 19th. Just as the holidays were beginning here, and then the issuance in the days after that of a major executive summary, 150 pages, summarizing in text its basic findings. And again, just this past week, an 850-page report that gives you in great detail, the results of its 18-month investigation into what happened on January 6th, what happened before January 6th, and what happened after January 6th. This omnibus review undertaken by the House Select Committee, now as of today, going out of business, as is every other committee of the 117th Congress. We know well that next week, the 118th Congress goes into session with the swearing in of all of the members of the House of Representatives and a third of the members of the United States Senate. Before the House Select Committee went out of business, or as it is going out of business in these waning hours of 2022, the House Committee once again issuing these major findings. I'm going to spend the next three segments of Morning Cannolis talking about what was said during the course of that Monday, December 19th hearing, and then most importantly, the specific findings that are in that executive summary and in this major report that supports it. Also, at the same time, we have these continuing releases by the House Committee of virtually all of the transcripts of the more than 100 people who testified in front of the House Committee. We have seen bits and pieces of some of that testimony on the screen when the committee had its many hearings over the period of the past 18 months. We're now getting the transcripts of all of those. Those transcripts also being released to not only the public for our consumption, but also to the United States Department of Justice, which, as we have talked about, we'll talk again at the end of our hour today about what happens next down the street at the United States Department of Justice, 9th and Constitution. What is the Department of Justice now doing? What are the next steps going on in the wake of the release of this report? What can we expect in 2023 from January 6th? Before we get there, some touchstones, some major headlines coming out of the hearing and big topic issues. Vice Chair Liz Cheney, who, as you know, was defeated in the primary to be the representative from the state of Wyoming. She said this. She said, every president in our history has defended this orderly transition of authority except one. Except one. And Liz Cheney, also again, a major, major player, one of two Republicans on this bipartisan committee established by Nancy Pelosi to review all this. The executive summary that followed upon the presentation by The full committee said this: the evidence has led to an overriding and straightforward conclusion, implicit if not explicit, in what Liz Cheney and everyone else has said from the committee. Basically this: the central cause of January 6th, the committee said, was one man, former President Trump, who many others followed. None of the events of January 6th would have happened without him. That, the key finding, the core focus of the committee hearing, the executive summary and the report, focusing first and foremost upon Donald Trump and saying that without him, without his being the linchpin, the core of all this, he's going to talk in just a moment or so about the conspiratorial nature of what the committee described, his being at the core of that conspiracy. Also in that initial and final presentation by Liz Cheney and others on December 19th, making this finding that Trump's senior staff ultimately admitted that they lacked the evidence sufficient to change the election result, and they admitted that what they were attempting was unlawful, telling the president on repeated occasions that he had lost the election, that there was no there, that the so-called big lie was just that, a lie, gargantuan in dimension given his perpetuation of it, but none of that true. Again, that coming out of the initial executive summary. We also know from those initial presentations by the committee that we had a lot of specific accounts describing, if you will, the president's intent, his mindset, things being said to him by his senior staff. And we know from some of those initial releases that two names reappeared in that final committee hearing of the 19th. One of them, Hope Hicks, a senior advisor to the president. She confronted the president, according to the committee, about his place in history. And the president apparently replied to that, "Nobody will care about my legacy." This, again, the former president speaking. He said, "If I lose, nobody will care about my legacy, so that won't matter. The only thing that matters," the president said, "is winning." Very significant in terms of revealing his mindset and the reason for his being at the core of this attempt to overturn the election in 2020. Kellyanne Conway, again, a major senior advisor to the president. You know her well, too, from all of her media appearances, a major player in the West Wing throughout his presidency, told President Trump that January 6th was a terrible day, in her words, to which the president responded, nope, Kellyanne, people are upset. They are very, very upset. Again, all of that revealing something about what his senior staff was telling him. We're going to get back to some of that as well. A lot of that also reported in these major releases by the committee. I'm going to spend most of our time in the next segment or so talking about these major referrals that were made by the House committee to the United States Department of Justice, identifying what, in the committee's view, the president had done in terms of committing actual crimes in violation of the federal criminal code. We're going to talk about those right after the break. Those announced by Jamie Raskin, who was not only a major member of this committee, but also, as you recall well, the chair, the major presenter of one of the impeachments of the president for January 6th. Right after the break, we're going to chat more about what those are, the four major charges advanced to the Department of Justice, what they're about, the focus of those, and what they may mean down the road. Stay with us here on Morning Cannolis for that exposition of those charges and the referrals made to the United States Department of Justice.
The Shaw, 101 FM, WAUK 540 AM, Wisconsin's home for rational talk radio.
CBS News Special Report. Condolences rolling in from around the world over the death of Pope Emeritus Benedict XVI, who has died at the age of 95. CBS's Stacey Lynn.
Outside the Vatican,
we feel very, very, very sad.
Crowds have been gathering all day to pay their respects.
I think it's the moment to think about the future of the earth, because the last pope had a strong message about respect for the nature, for peace with the earth.
Funeral services will be held on Thursday. They'll be presided over by Pope Francis.
Vatican spokesman Matteo Bruni.
From the morning of Monday, the body of the Pope Emeritus will be
in the Basilica of St. Peter's.
Benedict had been living at the Vatican since his resignation in 2013, side by side with Pope Francis. He was the first pope to step down in 600 years. He was also the first German pope in 1,000 years. CBS News Special Report. I'm Allison Keyes.
Join Max Inc. Radio this New Year's Eve as we present live at thespaceship.tv. Max Inc. Radio will broadcast live from the spaceship.tv studios 6 p.m. to midnight, plus live performances from the civil engineers. Linda and the Zeros. Porky's Groove Machine.
Who's there, the Spice Girls? Muy caliente.
Oh, they're not. Live streaming video at thespaceship.tv and live on this civic media station. Let's party New Year's Eve starting at 6 p.m. live from thespaceship.tv. Happy New Year's from Civic Media and Max Inc. Radio. We are local music.
You are listening to your local Civic Media radio station on air. Thank you. Did you know we are always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app too? And if you miss a show or game, find it wherever you get your podcasts or on our website, civicmedia.us.
You've got questions about navigating the healthcare system? Kristen Lyerly helps us find answers and discusses other issues at the intersection of healthcare and politics. Hometown Health, Thursday mornings at 7:30 on Up North News Radio.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I'm Rick Smith, host of The Rick Smith Show. And we are now on the air in Waukesha, live weeknights, 8 to 10 p.m., right here on WAUK 540 AM, 101 FM, The Shaw. Turn on, tune in, and help us rebuild the American dream. Check out our website at TheRickSmithShow.com. The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk. Weeknights, 8 to 10 p.m., right here on WAUK 540 AM, 101 FM, The Shaw.
So all you folks out there, if you haven't registered to vote, register to vote. Get ready to vote. There are so many things on the ballot this November, at our freedom, our liberty, and our way of life. But we'll get to all of that this evening.
The Paul Revere Show with Mark Thompson. Listen Monday, 7 to 8 p.m. on the Shaw 101 FM and WAUK 540 AM.
They were going to show a video of Roger Stone recorded by Danish filmmakers.
Just Google Roger Stone Monopoly Man.
You remember the old Batman TV series? He looks like the Penguin.
It's like a bad costume for A Christmas Carol.
Listen Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. for As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry.
And I know that firsthand because I was in that every year as a kid. Always a street urchin, never a cratchit.
That needs to be the title of your autobiography. Always a street urchin, never a cratchit.
As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry right here on The Shaw, 101 FM and WAUK 540 AM.
We are back. We're talking this morning about these very significant findings, these reportings coming out of the House Select Committee on the Insurrection of January 6th, even as we go into a new Congress in just a few days in its waking final moments of its existence. The House Committee on the Insurrection releasing this major report, 845 pages, among other things, finding just this. It says, in an effort to overturn the 2020 election and the results in key states, including right here in Wisconsin, ex-President Trump and his inner circle targeted election officials in at least 200 apparent acts of public or private outreach, pressure, or condemnation. 200 different acts identified by the House committee reviewing all of this. They go on to say that that included 68 meetings or attempted phone calls, connected or not connected, text messages aimed at state or local representatives, along with about 125 social media posts by the former president or his aides targeting these same officials out there. Huge amount of documentation about those 200 acts of outreach, pressure, condemnation, all these different meetings and attempts. some successful, not successful, to engage in conversation. All of that predicates for what Jamie Raskin announced publicly at the final hearing of the committee, and also now codified, not only in the executive summary, but also in this omnibus 845-page document about the referrals made by the House committee to the United States Department of Justice, as Jamie Raskin explained both publicly and in other interviews with the press, indicating that all of these were based upon the recommendations that the committee finds that these kinds of things should be looked at by the United States Department of Justice. As we have said on this broadcast repeatedly, the United States Department of Justice, again, pursuant to the separation of powers, plainly conducting its own independent investigation of all of this, plainly taking a look at all these transcripts now being produced by the committee, because it certainly is looking at the same witnesses, including the Hope Hickses, including the Kellyanne Conways, other people of the prior administration, but going to be making a decision not premised upon what the Congress wants it to do or based upon what Jamie Raskin thinks it should do, but what the evidence should show. That's the assignment given Jack Smith, who, as you know, is the special counsel responsible to the Attorney General for making recommendations, making decisions about what kinds of indictments might be presented to the federal grand juries. That a different proceeding, separate and apart from, but much related factually to these referrals made by the committee to the Department of Justice. So what are those? They're four in nature, and they are set forth in great detail in the report of the committee. The first one is obstruction of official proceedings in violation of 18 U.S.C. Section 1512. This, frankly, is probably the easiest to prove. Goes to the notion that what the president and others did stopped the voting from happening. We saw that in our own eyes. We saw that there was an attempt, and indeed for a while, for many hours, a success in obstructing the process of doing what? Selecting, identifying, and counting those electoral votes properly in front of the Speaker of the House of Representatives and in front of the Vice President, who is serving there as the President of the Senate. That, under Section 1512, from my perspective, the perspective of an awful lot of people out there, probably among the easier charges if the Department of Justice chooses to pursue this. Obstruction, influencing this process, again, multiple states involved, trying to get these false electors documents in front of the Vice President, in front of the Speaker of the House. Also, this pressure campaign upon the Vice President himself, maintaining improperly, unlawfully, inadequately, and without any justification, that he has the capacity to overturn what the electoral votes would in fact command, that all of that was an attempt to obstruct the proper governance, the official proceedings of the United States Congress, doing that knowingly, willfully, wrongfully, a fairly clear premise based upon all the evidence in the report, and probably also based upon the things that the Department of Justice is presenting right now to the United States grand juries convened right down the street at the federal courthouse there. A second charge, in addition to that, advanced, recommended, not compelled, but recommended by the House committee, a conspiracy to defraud the United States government in violation of Section 371, again, Title 18. Much related to the first, this attempt to obstruct the certification of the electors by the Vice President, by the Speaker of the House of Representatives, done in a deceitful or dishonest means. That's a part of the basic structure of Section 371. A big part of this, lying about the election, right? As extending to the population generally, this notion that the election was stolen. That would certainly be a part of this as well. Overt acts in furtherance of that conspiracy to defraud the government of the proper counting of these votes. Certainly many of them, including these outreach attempts to the Vice President. A lot of what we haven't talked about yet this morning, but involving a fellow named John Eastman and his attempts likewise to design this policy, this practice, this structure to overturn the results of the election. That a second charge, conspiracy to defraud the United States government, a bit more challenging to present, but not overwhelming, based upon the facts that the Department of Justice probably does have. Conspiracy, then, to make false statements, that in violation of 18 U.S.C. section 1001, also 371 of the United States Federal Code. This is all about the false electors scheme, right? The false electors to present to Congress, to the National Archives, coming out of Wisconsin and at least six other states, misrepresentations about what the Electoral College votes accurately did in fact say, material in its nature, plainly presenting, attempting to present to the Congress things that are false, falsely representing that here in Wisconsin, for example, our 10 electoral votes should in fact be cast in favor of Donald Trump, when in fact the president, vice president, now the president of our nation, Joe Biden, had won the presidency. Done with knowledge, done with a willful intent, patently false, plainly. Material in nature, the counting of the votes, significant in terms of the making of false statements, also having to do, again, at a central level with this notion of false electors presenting those to the United States Congress. And finally, the fourth charge also presented by the committee, presented to the United States Department of Justice, engaging in insurrection, citing, assisting, or somehow advancing an insurrection in violation of Section 2383 of Title 18 of the United States Code. And this focuses principally upon the ellipse, the things the president and others said, summoning the crowd there, encouraging them to march to the Congress itself to overturn the results of what was going on there, much related to the other charges proposed by the committee. Doesn't has a lot to do with the other charges and this overall plan, but also probably the most difficult, believe it or not, to show. And you might say, gee, how does that come about? We saw the president himself seemingly inciting violence, encouraging this kind of thing. We also know, based upon past Supreme Court cases, including a case called Brandenburg versus Ohio, the Supreme Court interpreting the law, interpreting Section 2383, and the general capacity under the First Amendment of politicians to say things out there that can, in fact, advocate. They talk a lot about the capacity of politicians to advocate, to fight for certain positions and advocate strongly. That, because of Brandenburg, might be a more difficult charge for the Department of Justice to bring, but nonetheless, a part of these overall recommendations, the four of them obstructing, influencing an official proceeding, conspiracy against the United States to defraud, making false statements, and engaging in insurrection, all of those coming out of this major report. That's the legal side of things coming out of this report to understand as this report is consumed by not only the Department of Justice, but also by all of us taking a look at it. Again, the Department of Justice under no obligation whatsoever to embrace or pursue any of that, but codifying from the committee's view the kinds of things that a grand jury might in fact indict on. I mentioned already this false electors scheme. We also know coming out of this major report, the 845 pages or so, this kind of thing. And here's what the report says. The plan on fake electors emerged from a series of legal memoranda written by an outside legal advisor to the Trump campaign. They identify him by name. His name is Kenneth Chesbrough, C-H-E-S-E-B-R-O, Kenneth Chesbrough. He's an attorney who sent a memo to Rudy Giuliani, again, one of the senior advisors to the president. We know him well, about what the committee said was a president of the Senate strategy. And that strategy, the report says, wrongly asserted that the vice president could select which presidential electors to count during this joint session of Congress, articulating there this problem with this plan. We're going to talk more about that and other things having to do with this report right after this break here at Morning Cannolis. Stay with us for that and more.
My bad, Jim. That was 4 minutes.
All right. Very good. We'll continue then with that continuing discussion about this. We'll continue right with that going forward here. So we know, again, that this fake electors plot coming out of this report, as it is described, that report, again, this Kenneth Chesbrough bringing a major architect, if you will, of this fake electors plot, a part of an overall larger description of a memorandum authored by John Eastman. We have talked a lot about him in the past. He also appeared along with Rudy Giuliani and others at the Ellipse on January 6th before the assault on the United States Capitol. John Eastman, in this now infamous memorandum, explaining these methods of overturning the popular and the electoral college results of the election of the previous November. That process, that authoring of this memorandum, reaching back into the states, including Wisconsin, attempting to put forth false electors, falsely representing what they, in fact, are all about. Representing, for example, that here in Wisconsin, we had not returned electors supporting the identification of Joe Biden as our next president. All of that, not only a portion of these recommendations made to the United States Department of Justice, but also identifying the players. And that's another major thing that the report does. Chesbro being among them, John Eastman being among them, again, identifying this not only as a state-focused effort, but also identifying wrongly, illegally, unlawfully, the notion that the vice president of the United States has this ability to choose and pick which electors he would most like to embrace for purposes of that, a major portion of this. And so we get then to things like the 14th Amendment as well. Knowing that the principal focus of this report has been and remains on Donald Trump, a major recommendation here about the 14th Amendment. As we know, 14th Amendment establishes that anyone who is engaged in insurrection, previously having taken an oath of office to support and defend the Constitution, anybody who engages in an insurrection or given aid or support to the enemies of the Constitution should be prohibited from holding any office, civil or military, under the United States of America. We know that out of New Mexico, we already have an invocation of that. A state court judge found that a state official in New Mexico should not take his position based upon that particular conviction under a federal violation, but under the Constitution should not take office there. Here in the report now, we've got the committee saying that Donald Trump himself should not hold office because he himself was involved in the insurrection. Among the 11 specific recommendations is that one, that Donald Trump not be permitted to hold any future office. We know he's already announced his candidacy for the presidency, and goes on to say the committee should create a formal mechanism for evaluating whether individuals who violate the 14th Amendment should be barred from future federal or state office. That having to do with the 14th Amendment. In our final segments, we'll talk more about what the future holds, not only for these referrals, but this report and the other contents of it. Stay with us here on Morning Cannolis.
It's easy to listen to your favorite local radio station anytime. Download the Civic Media app from the Apple or Google Play Store, then listen live or whenever you want from anywhere for free.
This is Pat Greitlow from Up North News Radio. On the air, online, or on demand, make it a point to catch the first word on Wisconsin news, sports, and more weekday mornings from 6 to 8 all across the stations of the Civic Media Radio Network.
Dueling Tangents with Luke and Brian.
I'm really trying hard not to go insane from the mind screw that is this situation. Yes. With I was going to say the GAB, but now it's the WEC, which is audited by the LAB, and then it's now screwed up by the GOP, and we're all SOL. Good for us. Congratulations.
Look at all those acronyms. Yeah.
We're the winners.
Tune in for Dueling Tangents every weekday at 2.
What is dedication?
People ask, how your children learn how to ride a bike and you didn't. I just created an environment where they taught themselves and all I had to do was be there.
That's dedication. Visit fatherhood.gov to hear more. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Ready for our little forest adventure?
Yes!
There's a forest closer than you think. Find a park or forest near you and music inspired by nature at discovertheforest.org. Brought to you by USDA Forest Service and the Ad Council.
Here's your updated forecast on the Shaw.
overcast skies this afternoon with daytime highs approaching 37. Southerly winds around 5 miles an hour. Cloudy skies expected tonight. Mixed precipitation possible at times. Lows level off around 32. Cloudy skies again tomorrow. Highs level off around 42. A dusting of snow tonight. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Derek Height. Currently, it's 23 degrees.
We are back in our final segment here on Morning Cannolis. Some final findings coming out of this major report of the January 6th House Select Committee. And those include evidence also of dereliction of executive duty to act to stop the violence. A huge amount, tremendous amount of very compelling testimony saying this: President Trump did not contact a single national security official during the day. That is January 6th. Not at the Pentagon, not at the Department of Homeland Security, the Department of Justice, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the Capitol Police Department, or the District of Columbia Mayor's Office. That's the specific language talking about these hours that passed when his own staff, his own family coming to him, asking him to call off the violence, doing nothing. And beyond that, not calling upon any law enforcement, likewise, to engage in some attempts to stop the violence there. We know that the vice president himself in a secure location, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi, doing just that, as did others, trying to get this under control. Significantly, the testimony of Mark Milley, who's the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said, "You're the commander in chief. You've got an assault going on at the Capitol of the United States of America. And there's nothing, no call, nothing, zero." All of that supporting this finding by the committee. The former president was derelict, not only in failing to act with respect to calling people off, but also failing to involve law enforcement in some major way. Before the break, I talked about Kenneth Chesbro, John Eastman. The committee goes on to describe many other co-conspirators, including Jeffrey Clark, a former major supervisor at the U.S. Department of Justice, who almost became our attorney general in the waning days of the Trump administration. Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, likewise identified in the committee report as a co-conspirator in many of these actions, along with, yes, Eastman and Chesbro, Rudy Giuliani, again, this senior figure in the Trump administration, all of them identified as supporting lieutenants of the ex-president in this broad scheme to overturn the 2020 election results. Interestingly, a state senator named Doug Mastriano, you may recall his name, he was a candidate for Republican governor at the time, a state senator in Pennsylvania. According to the report, he conferred regularly with Trump about securing letters from other state legislators in Pennsylvania asking Republican federal congressional leaders to reject the Pennsylvania electoral votes. Again, a part of this all-state process to get the electoral process undermined. A couple of additional, very significant things that have kind of fallen under the radar when it comes to major news coverage. Turns out there are also a blue team and a green team as a part of this overall effort administered by, executed by the House committee. The blue team is focusing upon law enforcement. And a lot of findings about the extent to which law enforcement prior to January 6th did its job says this: in the midst of a flood of threats of potential violence on social media, other avenues of that, law enforcement failed to share and act on those threats and jeopardized the lives of the police officers defending the Capitol and everyone in it. Among the other significant anecdotal support for that notion, there is an account from a Secret Service agent prior to January 6th saying that their plan, this is a direct quote, is literally to kill people. "Please, please," the Secret Service agent says, "take this tip seriously and investigate further." And again, a finding by the committee that law enforcement not properly prepared, not properly identifying and passing on this major information about what was about to happen. And then a green team also a part of the committee work, says this: the Trump campaign and the Republican National Committee raised more than $250 million based upon the president's false claims of a stolen election. Says this in particular. President Trump's claims were treated as true and blasted to millions of people with little to no scrutiny by those tasked with ensuring the accuracy of them. A Green Team report about the amount of money that was also made by the Trump campaign, by the RNC, as a result of this perpetuation of this false lie. And significantly, we talked about a lot of lawyers during the course of this. We know that the committee report also recommends that courts and bar disciplinary bodies responsible for overseeing the legal profession generally in states across the country, including the District of Columbia, should continue to evaluate the conduct of attorneys, yes, like Rudy Giuliani, like Sidney Powell and others, who are described in this report. And again, a major advocacy not only for the bar committees, but also for courts to take a look at what those attorneys did in advancing this false lie. And finally, in terms of significant things that come out of this, a recommendation about something that did in fact happen. Major amendments to the Electoral Count Act of 1887. Recommendations made on Thursday, passed by the United States Congress on Friday. The amendments, again, incorporated in the report, now a part of our law, the good thing coming out of this all, establishing a single conclusive process for recognizing the official slates of electors, again, addressing this false elector process that Eastman and others had designed that we've talked about, that the report also describes in great detail. How does it go about doing that? It says it identifies the governors as the people who are supposed to be certifying officially a specific elected officer, the governor or somebody else identified by the legislature to be the one person who says that this indeed is the proper and accurate and non-false, the real state of electors presented to the National Archives and to the Congress. An expedited review between the time of the election and the counting of those electoral votes for genuine contests, real contests, if in fact those exist, presumably in the federal courts, that also established by these amendments to the Electoral Count Act, and modernizing the counting rules, most significantly among those, establishing clearly that the Eastman concept, that the vice president has the role as the Senate leader to make decisions about electoral votes and counts, that he can in fact choose among them, that that's simply wrong. Establishing clearly that the vice president's role in this process is purely ministerial and raises the threshold for contesting electoral votes to 1/5 of the sworn members of the House of Representatives. Basically protecting, if you will, the process, recognizing that the president of the Senate, the vice president, is simply there to open up the envelopes and count them, does not have any substantive role in choosing which votes are to be identified and which votes are not. Again, the good news coming out of one of the last acts of this Congress, not only incorporating those proposed amendments into the Electoral Count Act, passed by the Senate in a bipartisan House, a bipartisan Senate, going on to the president as a part of this omnibus budget bill that was passed by the Congress and again signed by the president. And so now we do have electoral count changes that happen. All of that, a part of the results of this overall review by the House Committee. Thank you so very much for joining me this morning, as in every morning, as we talk about these important issues. We'll be back again next Saturday to talk about more news, doing more of our summary of 2022, and looking forward to 2023. Again, thanking you for your time together this morning. As always, here on Morning Cannolis, our review of law, justice, and the aspiration for justice in America. Have a good new year, everybody. We'll see you again next week.
Women hear a lot about self-care these days. Advice on ways to relax, exercise, eat healthy, and more. Those are all great. But one of the most important self-care steps we can take is making sure we're financially secure later in life. That means saving money for retirement. It's never too late to start. And it's the kind of self-care that brings peace of mind that lasts. For small steps you can take to save for retirement, visit WeSaySaveIt.org. That's WeSaySaveIt.org. A message from AARP and the Ad Council.
Do you love getting rewards when you shop? Then shop Knucklehead CBD and Vapes with the Knuckleheads Club. Every $10 spent gets you closer to 25% off. No matter what you buy, make sure you buy Knuckleheads. Stop in Saturday and Sunday and get 15% off Wellness and Wellness Plus, including Delta 8, THCP, CBD, and more, while getting points towards your next purchase.
Visit Knuckleheads Milwaukee at 2949 North Oakland Avenue or online at knuckleheads.shop.
Knuckleheads CBD and Vapes, your one-stop smoke shop.
You are listening to WAUK 540 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, always streaming on the Civic Media app.